From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
I want readers to think about barbershops in a different way. So I talk about barbershops as commercial public spaces, right? So we talk about barbershops as spaces where African-American men go and they can talk and hang out and think. But what we fail to do is to think about the barber in this discussion of barbershops. And so what we should be reminded of, and I think this book does that, is that barbering and barbershops have been one of the critical areas of the economy that African-Americans have had access to, right? So historically, barbershops were usually some of the most numerous businesses in most cities, and beauty shops as well. And so with very low barriers to entry, one can become a barber fairly easily.
Professor Quincy T. Mills, Associate Professor of History at Vassar College and author of Cutting Along the Color Line, Black Barbers and Barbershops in America. During the 19th century, black-owned barbershop had mostly prominent white clientele. It was difficult for a black man to approach a black barber for a shave or haircut using the same instrument he used on white customers, even in the North. The shops were run by either slaves or waiting men or freedmen and were competition for white barbers. The rationale used by black barbers was considered economic necessity. As long as the white men continued to patron the black barbershops, the barber's family had stability and the ability to provide for his family in a middle-class household. The profession was also attractive to the black barber because the conditions of working inside were much better than the field or backbreaking labor. I'm Johnny O. Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, Cutting Along the Color Line, Black Barbers and Barbershops in America, with Professor Quincy T. Mills, In Black America.
Many barbers began as personal servants to, many African Americans entered barbering as personal servants to their masters, essentially. And so what we have, particularly in the South in the 19th century, we have black barbers, some slaves, some free, who were shaving white aristocrats, white businessmen, politicians. And so many of their customers were slave owners. And so, but in these shops, you have, again, free blacks who are owning the shops in many cases, who employed other free black men as barbers, but also employed slaves working in these shops. Because during downturns in the Southern economy, many plantation owners would hire out their skilled slaves to gain some extra income in cases where their personal servants were idle, for example. And so many of those hired out barbers were slaves, keep in mind, but they were living virtually free, working in these free black barbershops.
After emancipation, the black-owned barbershops were open to serve black clientele. That was the beginning of the barbershop as a sanctuary for black men. Unfortunately, the number of black barbershops began to decline with the demand for formerly trained barbers and changes in state law and cosmetology. Today, black-owned barbershops play a central role in African-American public life. The intimacy of commercial grooming encouraged both confidentiality and camaraderie, which make the barbershop an important gathering place for African-American men to talk freely. In his research, Professor Quincy T. Mills finds that the profession played a significant, though complicated, role in 20th century racial politics. While the service of shaving and grooming were instrumental in the creation of socially acceptable black masculinity, barbering permitted the financial independence to maintain public spaces that fostered civil rights politics. This sweeping, engaging history of an iconic culture establishment shows that black entrepreneurship was closely linked to the struggle for equality.
When I started my master's in business administration at DePaul, I was sort of still thinking about what to do with business, because I did my undergrad degree in business. Like many students of color, I entered the fields that would provide me with those signs of mobility and those signs of success. And so for me, it was business. But as an undergraduate business major, I took a lot of my electives in the history department. And so in the process of studying history, studying African-American literature, African-American politics, African politics, I had to do something with my interest. And there was a history professor, Juliet Walker, who teaches at UT Austin, who encouraged me to really think about the academy and think about studying history as a profession. And so, but I still sort of had a slight interest in going into the business world. And so I started an MBA program at the same time that I started a master's program at the U of Chicago. At the point that I got into the doctoral program at U of Chicago, I put the business degree aside and focused on my historical studies. And eventually I did certainly go back and finish the coursework for the MBA. But ultimately, this period of my life was in figuring out how to merge my interest in business and my love for history. And so what came out of that was this larger focus, research focus on African-American business history.
Being associated with Professor Walker, I'm quite sure at some time during that tenure, you hung out with John Hope Franklin.
I had the great opportunity to meet John Hope Franklin on a couple of occasions. He was just a really wonderful historian, a wonderful person. I'm richer for having had those brief meetings with him.
Yeah, I understand. How did an African-American with dreadlocks come to write a book on barbershops?
I got to tell you, so I was working with Melissa Harris Perry on her first book, Barbershops, Bibles, and BET. And she needed someone to help her with the research end for the barbershop piece. And so she figured that if she tried to sit in the barbershop for several days, she would just completely alter this organic nature of the shop. And so she asked me to do it. So I sat in this barbershop, Truth and Soul, the South Side of Chicago, for 4 to 5 days a week in the summer of 2000, and just observed the interactions, the conversations, how men were relating to each other. In the process of thinking about this work for Melissa's book, I couldn't help but think about this space historically, right? Mm-hmm. And so I began to dig into the archives and see if I can find something about the history of barbershops. Now, yes, I had started growing my dreadlocks in 1999, but again, this was my personal choice. It wasn't an affront against the barbershop, but just, the way that I wanted to grow my hair. And so I didn't see my hair related to my research, which seems odd, but for me, the research was the work. That was the product. That was about learning about people who lived before me, learning about what others or how others had engaged in this shop and in this profession. But my own personal appearance, for me at least, didn't matter. But certainly as I began to talk to particularly barbers in the South, it did matter to them. And it mattered greatly because they did not believe that I could fully represent their history as barbers if I was not patronizing the barbershop. And so there were some very interesting interactions and conversations that I had with him over that.
When you began this journey, was there much written material on African-American barbers and barbershops in this country?
No, most historians certainly would give passing mention and reference to the number of barbershops in a particular city or their significance to Black communities over time, particularly during those, the rise of African-American urban history right after the 1960s and 1970s. But no one really dug deep. No one focused their attention on this space historically. For the most part, I think we have accepted that barbershops were these spaces where Black men can go and relax and hang out and talk and be free. And we've assumed that they've historically always been this way. But certainly as a historian, our first job is to not assume much, but to actually do the research and to find out the ways in which these spaces have changed over time. And so to answer your question, no, scholars had not done that. There was certainly a scholar who was working on this topic along with me. He wrote this book, Knights of the Razor, Doug Bristol, where he focused on the 18th and 19th centuries looking at barbers. But I wanted to focus on the 19th and 20th centuries for my work, though.
Before we get into some of the research and some of your written literature, we all seen the barbershop that was put out in 2002 and then Barbershop 2. There was some controversy with that as far as the barbershop being a sanctuary, but some of the dialogue was somewhat stereotypical of giving white America the wrong impression of what actually goes on in an African-American barbershop.
The controversy that you're talking about certainly revolves around the comments made in the first Barbershop film about Rosa Parks.
Right.
And said the entertainer's character made the statements that Rosa Parks didn't do anything but sit down, but that there were a lot of other people who refused to give up their seat long before Rosa Parks did. So there's a couple of ways to think about that statement and that in this larger controversy. Mm-hmm. So one, thinking about the context of what was said in the film. And the fact is, he was correct. There were tons of other people, actually, who refused to give up their seat on the bus. And the Montgomery bus boycott particularly didn't start with them.
Right.
Claudette Colvin is just one example, who was a teenager who mm-hmm. refused to give up her seat, was arrested. And once folks began to think about organizing a boycott around Colvin, some unsavory things came out that she was pregnant, that she wouldn't be able to withstand a long movement and the scrutiny that would come out of that. And so many decided, and particularly many men, decided that this was not the right test case. And so Rosa Parks proved to be a much more respectable figure for that. And so what happens in that dialogue in the film is to say that, how are we thinking about history and how are we thinking about the sort of public symbols of African-American history vis-a-vis the larger masses of people who usually are behind most movements? The other part here, right, which is more to your question, is about, we think of barbershops as private spaces.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you have this film on barbershops, essentially it becomes public because it's a film. And so the conversation that happened in the barbershop on film was now made public, right? Yeah. Everyone could see it. Everyone can see folks talking about Rosa Parks and not saying nice things about Rosa Parks. And that's what's most interesting to me about the movie and indeed about barbershops, is because they are private spaces in the public sphere. They are spaces where African Americans can go and talk freely, right, without yeah. surveillance. And so when you have this film that portrays this public conversation and the kinds of conversations that happen regularly, right? Essentially, you know, these men in the film were challenging this dominant narrative. Now, granted, let's be clear, Rosa Parks' action was quite critical and quite significant, right? All movements are about strategy. And certainly this was no different. And so we have to sort of recognize that. So in that respect, Seth's character was indeed wrong. Her actions were not simply just not giving up her seat, but they were really courageous actions. And certainly we know that Rosa Parks was very active long before that December day to not give up her seat. But again, what we get from these spaces is this unsurveilled space where men can indeed talk freely without someone saying, you can't say that. And I think that's what is really critical about the history of Black public spaces and Black public spheres, where both men and women, right, would have the freedom and the space to engage in critical dialogue.
I understand. If you're just joining us, I'm Johnny O'Hanson Jr., and you're listening to In Black America from KUT Radio. And we're speaking with Professor Quincy T. Mills, author of Cutting Along the Color Line, Black Barbers and Barbershops in America. In chapter one, you address barbering for freedom in the antebellum America. In the beginning, African-American barbers were barbers to basically a white clientele. Is that correct?
That's absolutely right. Many barbers began as personal servants to many African Americans entered barbering as personal servants to their masters, essentially. And so what we have, particularly in the South in the 19th century, we have Black barbers, some slaves, some free, who were shaving white aristocrats, essentially,
right.
White businessmen, politicians. And so many of their customers were slave owners. And so in these shops, you have, again, free Blacks who are owning the shops in many cases,
mm-hmm.
who employed other free Black men as barbers, but also employed slaves
right.
working in these shops. Because during downturns in the Southern economy, many plantation owners would hire out their skilled slaves to gain some extra income in cases where their personal servants were idle, for example. And so many of those hired out barbers were slaves, keep in mind, but they were living virtually free, right? Working in these free black barbershops. But, of course, these slaves would be the first to say that living free was not the same as being free,
right?
And so anytime their master would call them back for their slaves to give them a portion of their income from their barbering work, that reminded them that, yeah, I'm still enslaved. But being able to get away from the plantation, to get away from the master, gave them this really critical space, not just to earn money, but also in but also to escape. And so many barbers did indeed, many slave barbers did indeed escape. But we have this really fruitful space of of free and enslaved barbers working together. And it sort of, again, opens up a larger discussion of discussion about race, freedom, and labor.
When we look at the South in comparison with the whites-only drinking fountains, were they the same in barbershops? Could they use the same instruments on African-American
clients? Absolutely. Not in the light of day. So white men did not want black men in these black-owned barbershops as customers, right? So for white patrons, they only wanted to see black men as barbers, as bootblacks, as porters in these shops. They didn't want to see black men as customers in these shops. Essentially, they didn't want to be shaved next to a black man being shaved, because that would have caused some concerns about social equality. And so, no, they didn't want to be shaved with the same razor that would have touched a black man's face. But of course, how in the world would they have known, right?
Exactly.
They certainly could not have known. And so it's as ridiculous as it sounds for white men to not want to be shaved with the same razor, more than likely they were shaved with the same razor. More than likely, although black men were not allowed to come in during the day, more than likely, I certainly believe that once the shop closed for the day, that it probably opened up again for black men to come in to get shaved on the down low, again, not to, so as not to offend and drive away these wealthy white clients.
What status did the African-American barber have within his own community?
These barbers made quite a bit of money. So one, they were exceptionally wealthy, both, you know, before the Civil War and after the Civil War. They were also, so they were critical figures of the black middle class.
Okay.
Now, they were also critical because they actually owned spaces. Well, leased spaces, I should say. They had control, some control over a space. And so African American barbers in the South and the North were quite influential in the Underground Railroad. They were quite influential in trying to sort of keep black communities tied in a way. At the same time, these barbers also caught some hell because African Americans could not go into their shops.
Right.
And so you have these barbers, again, central to black middle class politics, and they tried to certainly stay connected to black communities by being involved in the church, by being involved in fraternal societies, and certainly living and working among black communities outside of their barbershops. But at the same time, black communities said, wait a minute, but we can't even get shaved in your barbershop. So how well can you represent black communities if you cannot stand up for black communities? And so there's this really interesting tension happening in the North and the South, but it played out quite starkly in the North, but it's also happening in the South as well.
After emancipation, black-owned barbershops were open to serve African-American clientele, but also when that happened, some of the rules changed as far as African-Americans now have to become licensed to be barbers, with very little or no barber colleges, as we can speak of.
That's right. So before the 1880s, most men learned how to be barbers by learning by being barbers, right? They picked up a razor and learned how to shave.
And we know about those places, don't we?
We know about those places, right? And so they took up an apprenticeship in a barbershop, right. And someone taught. But right around the early 1890s, German barbers entered, and certainly they didn't mind being barbers because they were barbers in the old country. Mm-hmm. They populated many cities and opened up several barbershops. Most native whites didn't want to be barbers because they associated barbering with servile slave labor,
okay.
Unskilled labor. So they didn't want to be barbers. Germans didn't care. But German barbers founded the German Barbers Union of America. And this barbers union wanted to essentially reskill barbering. So they wanted to take it out of this profession or trade, I should say, that was dominated by black men who were shaving white men in downtown cities. Most folks sort of looked at shaving as the unskilled and effeminate part of the barber's duties.
Mm-hmm.
Effeminate because when you shave someone, you have to sort of touch their face, you have to massage their face. And so for white men, that wasn't manly enough. And so the Barbers Union pushed for licensing laws. Now, these licensing laws were designed essentially to create some exclusivity to entering barbering. At the same time that the American Medical Association was founded and the American Bar Association was founded in the 1890s, they were establishing this sense of exclusivity, and barbers attached themselves onto this larger progressive era movement.
Right.
And so they wanted men to go to a barber college, to sit for a state licensing exam, and to essentially be monitored by the state or the health department because they wanted to be sure, as they said, that barbershops were sanitary. Again, this sort of this was the rhetoric around policing black barbershops because they wanted to protect the white public from
right.
going into black barbershops that were unsanitary, unhealthy, black men who were not trained. And so again, this is about a larger competition for this wealthy white market. Now, this effort to pass licensing laws was easily successful in some cities, in some states, but difficult in others. So in a state like Ohio, where this barber, George Myers, who was quite influential, he was William McKinley's barber before McKinley was elected president.
Right.
And so Myers worked in Cleveland, but the Republican machine brought Myers in to help organize black voters. And so Myers had a direct line to the Ohio state legislature in mm-hmm. a way that most African Americans didn't, outside of, say, Booker T. Washington, for example.
Right.
And so Myers actually prevented a licensing law from being passed in Ohio between 1902 and 1933. Now, the irony is that in 1933, that's when Myers passed away. And Ohio actually passed a licensing law in 1934. Again, because Myers had political connections. And he said, look, if you let this licensing law pass, which essentially is an effort to push black barbers out of the trade, then I will be sure that African Americans do not support the Republican ticket. And so he sort of used the vote as a way to keep this law from passing. But in a state like Virginia, where the first bill was introduced in 1924, and was introduced repeatedly for several years until it finally passed in 1962. And so it kept being rejected all those decades. It was rejected ultimately because the white legislature did not want to displace black barbers. Now, you might wonder, why would this white Southern legislature talk about the rights of black barbers between the 1920s and 1960s when, you know, for the most part, they really didn't care about African Americans writ large.
Right.
Well, ultimately, these white men did not want to lose their black barbers because they did not want to lose their black servants.
Okay.
And so for them, barbers, black barbers, they were part of the black servile class.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had lost the Civil War, right? That
right.
lost cause was gone. But this was a cause that they did not want to lose. They didn't want to lose their black barbers / servants. They didn't want to lose their black domestics because this was a reminder of the vestiges of the old South. And so they did not want this law to pass because they did not want to lose their black barbers. And so eventually, again, this did pass because a new generation of black barbers in Virginia particularly were concerned that, and I'm now thinking about Richmond, that there were black barbers coming from D.C. into Richmond because Richmond and other cities in Virginia, because there was no licensing law.
Right.
And this is around processing. This is the 1950s and 60s where processing hair was huge.
Right.
And so there were folks coming in from D.C. setting up processing shops. Mm. And so the black barbers were now concerned about competition from D.C. barbers, right? And so they actually helped to pass a licensing law at that point in Virginia to help, you know, get rid of the sort of rogue D.C. barbers who were setting up processing shops there.
I understand. If you're just joining us, I'm Johnny O. Hanson, Jr., and you're listening to In Black America from KUT Radio. And we're speaking with Professor Quincy T. Mills, author of Cutting Along the Color Line, Black Barbers and Barbershops in America. Professor Mills, today African-American barbershops play a central role in the African-American community and public life. When did black barbershops become the civic, cultural, and business institutions in many of our major cities?
So it started right around the earliest was the 1890s, but certainly by the 1900s and the 19-teens. A new generation of African-American men entered barbering in the 1890s, and they were among the first generation of African-Americans born after the Civil War, right? So they were born in freedom, and they came of age during the rise of segregation. And they opened barbershops in black communities, and they wanted to groom black men specifically. They were not as connected to the white South particularly, like their fathers and grandfathers were. And so they opened shops in black communities. So when we think about the Great Migration and we think about the Great Depression, these are two historical moments where we see barbershops beginning to serve this larger purpose in the organization of black communities. And so in the South, many, many men sat in barbershops and read the Chicago Defender, for example. We know that the Chicago Defender was a huge catalyst for fueling the Great Migration and encouraging African Americans to think about it and indeed to move north.
Professor Quincy T. Mills, Associate Professor of History at Vassar College and author of Cutting Along the Color Line, Black Barbers and Barbershops in America. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at jhanson, H-A-N-S-O-N, at KUT.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. You can hear previous programs online at KUT.org. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny O. Hanson, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.